May it please this honorable court, counsel. Your honors, I represented Jeanette George, a person who made every effort to develop a legitimate marketing business, and her activities were legitimate and should not be found to have been illegal under the anti-kickback statute. So I have two arguments to make, and I made them at trial, a bench trial. What she did was not illegal, and if someone were to think it was illegal, then she did not violate the statute, which requires an element of willfulness, because it's both complex and it's broad.
So, Mr. Clavelli, I can understand that people in general might not understand why the anti-kickback law forbids paying per patient referral. But I thought Ms. George did even testify that she got $500 every time a patient she referred was admitted or readmitted. Yeah. And I also would like you to address the fact that even though other people may be in the chain, there might need to be a doctor to certify, that's not enough to relieve somebody of their responsibility under the law.
Your Honor, I don't think the law is that clear. Certainly the Miles case, which I'd like to talk about a little bit later, they received $300 per patient. This is not just about the amount of the remuneration, because that could always be adjusted civilly during an audit. It's about should she have gotten paid or not, and both agents testified that her services were legitimate and she was entitled to being paid. Now, I want to go right to the heart of Your Honor's...
Mr. Clavelli, was the trial court just wrong when the trial court found that when she was arrested, she stated that she began receiving payments in cash, around November 2011, and that she was paid $500 per patient, and that she realized that it was illegal to be paid per patient. I mean, that alone, it would seem, would be sufficient to uphold the conspiracy conviction. I mean, was the trial court wrong?
I guess I'm going to have to say that the trial court person that I tremendously respect, I'm sorry, he's gone, was wrong in this instance. And if you'll allow me to explain and to also answer your first question,
Sure.
Both Miles and the Patel case from this circuit have a statement, which is, what is the purpose of the anti-kickback statute? And according to both of those cases, the purpose is to ensure that the doctor uses independent judgment and that the patient care is not compromised. Now, the Patel decision goes a little further, but the focus is on the doctor. The doctor is in control, and is in control because they certify. So, for instance, in Patel, the doctor got paid for his examinations and all the legitimate things he did, and which led to a certification of Medicare services, and then got paid $500, I think, per patient just because of the referral. Well, my client didn't get paid for her referral. She got paid for her marketing activities, which were extensive. And that's the same with the Miles case.
But isn't she the one who identifies these people for at least potential? I mean, she weeds through a lot of people.
No,
she has
question.
Marketing services. She weeds through a lot of people. She sends, a few over, and then the doctors certify, half of that. I think like 100 over and 50 are certified, or, 94 are over.
I actually wanted to talk about that. Yeah. So she sent out thousands of mailers. Spoke to hundreds and hundreds of people, telling them they may have benefits, which they can claim. How many of them went to other doctors or other service providers, who knows?
No, but no, here, but 90. Nobody, that's not what she got indicted for, though, the mailers.
Here, 90 came to her. Right. She spoke with them. She probably spoke to a lot more. But 90, she felt qualified, elderly, and were homebound. So she refers them to Rosner. Rosner sends out a doctor, and on 55 of the 90, only 61%, the doctor agreed and certified. So clearly, she is not the relevant decision maker, because the doctors acted independently. And the people, even though she is recommending, just like the premier people did in Miles, recommended this service provider, they could have gone anywhere once they've got the doctor's prescription. Now, let me address Judge Rovner's comment about she admitted. There's four important events here. In November of 10, she gets a written contract, which says in the email, it's in the Appendix D, this contract is more legally sound. A couple of months later, she sees this book online, and she sends an email saying she's concerned. Then, starting in March of 12, the cooperator starts recording her, and they waits all the way until July 13th to say, why do you want checks? Well, a person that willfully wants to violate the statute, they don't accept checks, and you won't find another case in the system where kickbacks were paid by checks, only in this case. So she says, well,
she gets cash too sometimes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the cash began before November of 11, began mm-hmm. in March of 11. And she said it raised a red flag. But Hernell, she counted on Hernell, and he said, you have a contract, it's legal. So then on a week later, she goes there again, and he says, well, did you consider what I said about taking checks in addition to cash? Do you want to, you know, you're leaving a paper trail. Do you want to still take checks? And she says, yes, I want checks. Her last three payments were checks. Now, a week later, she's arrested, and they say to her, did you know that it was illegal to be paid per patient? Well, Hernell had just told her it was illegal to be paid per patient. July 13th, he comes right out and tells her that. The question is, did she know it was illegal to be paid per patient, which I maintain it's not, in April and May, which are the two substantive counts?
I don't know how you can say that it isn't, though. I mean, I just, looking at the language of the statute, it seems that that's just one of the things you can't do. Now, I realize you also have your safe harbor arguments,
right.
And the district judge doesn't buy them. Either one of them is the employee, right, and the other is the underserved areas, but there's no evidence that they've actually jumped through the hoops to be an underserved area?
Well, the language is volume and value. Well, she got $57,000 for her people had 114 start of cares, $500 per the 90 people, and Rosner got 520 some thousand for her referrals. Clearly was not based on value, which is what happened in Vernon when they got the patient advocate got the percentage, and didn't do anything to earn it. Just like in Pullen, the salesman got $50 for giving it to a service provider because he could do it because the doctors let him do it. He didn't do anything to earn that 50, where she did a lot of legitimate work and earned her 500.
But now, where in the statute does it say you can be paid per patient as long as you're providing real services per patient?
The safe harbor.
Well,
the personal services safe harbor, the contract which was written by Rosner's director of marketing, who did not appear as a witness even though he had this plea agreement, and could have said, well, you know, she is the only one that had this contract. She is the only one that got paid by check. And the check stubs, which were found in Rosner's offices, said business promotion, marketing expense. So how could it not be a legitimate cost of doing business?
Well, again, you know, she's being paid by the patient. I'm looking at the medically underserved safe harbor, and maybe she could have produced, maybe there was evidence that this was a federally qualified health center, but that's a specific statutory thing. And I don't see where this is a personal service contract that does not take into account volume of referrals.
It's a referral agency. It's a marketing agency.
Well, that's the problem. It's not, but it's, and if all she did was market, you know, then maybe it would be a different case.
Well, you're marketing on behalf of a client, just like Premier marketed on behalf of the service provider in Miles.
But her compensation isn't just some fixed fee that Rosner pays her at the end of the year for being their advertising agency. So
it was set in advance. It was fixed. It was fair market value, which is what one of the emails said by Hernell. This is what all the agencies pay. And who is going to pay somebody for sending out mailers and talking to people that never produces a client? That'd be like paying a salesman for showing up who doesn't sell any cars. No one's going to do that. It's a piecemeal business. And how can you make a crime based on how the remuneration was calculated? The real question is, should they have gotten any money at all? And that's what all of these cases say. Pullen shouldn't have gotten the $50. The patient advocate shouldn't have gotten the percentage. And Shoemaker distinguishes Miles but does not overrule it.
It narrowed. I mean, people had kind of taken Miles and run with it, and Shoemaker comes along.
It definitely narrows it.
You know, that's too much.
We are right. We are right there with Miles. The only thing is that my client spoke with the patients, where the Miles people spoke with the physicians. But both of them are before any certifications, and they don't impact or influence the doctor's decisions. And
they create the pool of people from whom the doctors are choosing. In that sense, they've influenced it already.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
So, okay.
All right. So, Your Honor, and I also, as I said, I believe that she showed by wanting a written contract, by saying she preferred checks, that she wanted to do everything legitimately and thought she was, until this July 13th when, as my client says on tape to Hernell, who says, well, you know, you can't do this. You're not an employee. You can't get paid per patient. And she says, well, you're sending me mixed signals. Well, what does that mean except you're giving me double talk? First you tell me it's legal as can be. Now you're telling me it's not legal a year and a half later. And she never makes another referral after July 13th.
Right. I know that's the end. Well,
anyway, Your Honor.
Thereafter. But if you'd like to save a few minutes for rebuttal, that would be fine.
Thank you, Judge.
Sure.
But I think the only point the government's going to make is that she made the admission, and the admission only goes back to July 13th. Prior to that, she was never asked. In April and May of 2012, when you were charged, did you believe it was illegal? She would have said, oh, no, I thought it was legal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Lee?
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Lee. As the District Court concluded in its opinion denying the defendant's post-trial motion, the evidence here was sufficient for a reasonable finder of fact to find the defendant guilty, as the District Court had done in its opinion. The elements of the violating the anti-kickback statute were proven. The evidence showed that the defendant knowingly and willfully received remuneration from Rosner in return for her sending patients to Rosner.
So why shouldn't it
matter
given
that? On numerous occasions, she appeared to try and conform her actions to the law and try and gain assurances from Hernell that her actions were lawful. Given that he was working, you know, acting on behalf of the government at some point, Is this similar, do you think, to the safe house robbery cases where a crime is manufactured or at least furthered rather than avoided?
No, Your Honor. I do not think it's like the safe house cases. And I think it might be helpful to step back and consider the chronology here, because I think defense counsel made some mistakes in explaining how events unfolded over the course of the scheme and the government's cooperator. I think it's important to note that there are two key periods here. There's the period initially when the defendant began working with Rosner, when she got the contract in November 2010, and when she sent that email to Gary Hernal in March 2011 about the concerns she had developed about the legality of their conduct. And up until that time, I think it would be difficult for the government to show that she was acting willfully in that particular period. The problem is that whatever happened at that time, even if Gary Hernal had provided assurances to her in March 2011 that their conduct was legal, the defendant herself admitted that when she started receiving cash payments from Rosner sometime after March 2011 and before late 2011, she knew that what they were doing was illegal, and she kept doing it. So she knew by late 2011 that their conduct was illegal, and she continued to do it nonetheless. And she was continuing to do this when the government began recording in March 2012, and she continued to accept this money and to expect this money even after that July 13th, 2012 recording. Now, defense counsel misrepresented some of the facts of that July 13th, 2012 recording. He said that the discussion was of how the defendant wanted all the payments in cash. I'm sorry, that she wanted the payments in checks, and that she talked about that in the recording. The recording transcript is actually very different. She says, when referring to the payments, that it could all be in cash, and that she wanted the payments in cash, it's just that Rosner wanted to pay her in check. So it's very different from what defense counsel presented. And tellingly, by the conclusion of that recording, it was clear that there had been discussion where both sides knew that what they were doing was illegal. And then she continued nonetheless. That wasn't the last recording. There were additional recordings, additional discussion of her receiving payments on a per-patient basis for the patients she had referred. So the chronology is very different than what defense counsel represented, and it shows that even if she did not act willfully in that early time period, 2010, early 2011, she was acting willfully by the time of each of the counts of conviction, and that she knew what she was doing, she was acting willfully by late 2011 onwards. So in terms of the Miles case, defense counsel has talked about that case. I think there's some key distinctions, again, between what was going on in Miles and what was happening here. Now, the Miles case, first of all, that involved a marketing company that simply showed up to doctors' offices and dropped off advertising brochures about the services of the home health agency it was marketing on behalf of.
So I take it it's the government's position that if she got paid some amount of money per year for scouring doctor's offices or dropping off brochures about their agency in the population in this zip code or whatever, that all would have been fine.
I think that would be much more like what happened in the Miles case. That would be more like just simply advertising activities. But
how literally does the government take this notion that there can't be consideration of the volume of patients or the volume of users of the home health service or what have you? Anything at all related to volume? Like, yes, your advertising efforts were worth it because we're starting to get some interest, you know, what?
Well, I think under the Miles decision, it is not so much the volume, it's the volume tied to the referrals.
That's right. So the payments don't violate the act because all they're doing is giving the materials to the doctors and connecting the doctors and the agency when the doctors reach out, right?
Yes. In the Miles case, the doctor was the one who made the decision, oh, my patient might benefit from home health services. Oh, I will send them to this agency that I just received a brochure of.
So why isn't that very close to what happened here? 90 people, after she scoured through them, show up. The doctors don't just rubber stamp it. The doctors could have said two people out of the 90 were good candidates for the services that this company provided.
Because there's not just one decision at play here. The first decision, and the one that the defendant did have control over, is which agency the patient would go to in the first place. This is not a situation where the defendant talked to the patient about talking to her doctor about whether home health services would be useful and to consider Rosner. This was the case where, as we saw from the one patient who testified at trial, the defendant got the patient's name, the defendant made the choice about which agency to send the patient to, and
well,
the
she works only for Rosner, though. It's not like she has some stable of agencies, is it?
She, as far as the evidence showed, she only was working on behalf of Rosner.
Only Rosner, right. That's what I thought.
So she made the decision. So the patient didn't know which agency was going to come. She didn't make a decision about this. So the defendant was the one who made the decision, the first decision about which agency would get the patient. That agency then got a doctor to sign off on the home health services that Rosner wanted paid for. That's a different issue.
But if she hadn't been paid by the patient, I mean, at some level, I feel so. You know, we're talking about these elderly, homebound, maybe partially suffering from dementia people. Isn't it very fictional to think that they couldn't use an expert recommendation about a home health service?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is that terrible?
Your Honor, the patient could have used her own doctor. That if she, patients have doctors, patients should be turning to medical professionals to make these decisions based on the best interest of the patient. They shouldn't. The point of the anti-kickback statute is to protect that relationship.
Sounds like a doctor cartel statute.
Do doctors have time in their conferences with and examinations of patients to engage in that kind of counseling anymore?
I don't know, Your Honor. It depends on what the doctor relationship with the patient is. And
how it's funded and what kind of time pressure is put on the doctor and so on. You're offering a model of counseling that may be more the exception than the norm these days.
Your Honor, the point of the anti-kickback statute, one of the purposes is to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse. The whole point of the system and anti-kickback statute is to try to keep these undisclosed financial incentives from shaping things, and which leads to waste and abuse.
I thought that the point of the statute was to say that if whoever the referring person is, the doctor, the physician's assistant, kind of a freelancer like Ms. George, is getting people to go based on money versus based on medical need, then incentives are out of line. We want people to get effective medical care. Now, this may be a very romantic view of the way the medical profession works these days, but I thought that was the notion, that you didn't want doctors saying, you know, I'm referring you here because I'm going to get a kickback, whether it's for physical therapy or whether it's for home health care, whether it's for anything else. You want the doctor to be deciding on the merits, and this is one tool that the government has adopted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Counsel, could I ask you to address just one point made in the appellant's brief, which was apparently you relied at least to some degree on evidence about what Ms. George said to agents at the time of her arrest. And the appellant's brief says that the agent did not make a report of the George interview nor take any notes of that interview. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. There was a report of that interview. It was multiple pages. In terms of the notes, I don't recall myself if the defendant necessarily requested those notes. But
was the report admitted into evidence by any chance, or not?
I don't know if the report was admitted in evidence, but the report was produced and...
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And, Your Honor, one final point. The defendant counsel talked about how the compensation that the defendant received was not fixed. That's incorrect. She was paid on a per-patient basis. That was the arrangement throughout the time of her arrangement with
her. What about all this cross-examination based on the ultimate guide? There's a complaint in the record about that. I mean, isn't it a little heavy-handed for the prosecutor to stand there, whether it's you or somebody, but stand there and read off excerpts of this thing? Was the whole book introduced or just these excerpts?
Your Honor, the defendant herself, in her case, on her direct examination, she introduced and admitted into evidence the whole book. And she testified that she had, and the evidence that she presented was that somehow she had read parts of the book enough to have concerns about the legality of what she was doing. And that's what sparked the email in March 2011 to Gary Hernal.
And the government did. Nobody wanted to call Hernal. The government doesn't call Hernal. She doesn't call Hernal. Why is that?
Your Honor, the government made the decision not to call Gary Hernal, but also the defendant made the decision not to call Hernal. He was available to both sides. Either side could have called him. Neither side chose to call him. And ultimately, even if the district court did not abuse its discretion in not considering him a missing witness, and I think partially part of that is this, even if the court had considered him a missing witness, the only issue that Gary Hernal could have supported the defendant on is this idea that in March 2011, he did provide some assurances to her that their conduct was legal. Now, even if he had done so, she admitted that later that year, by late 2011, she knew their conduct was illegal. So there would have been no effect even if he had testified to the extent that defendant would have liked. Unless the court has any further questions, the government asks you to affirm the conviction.
All right, thank you. Mr. Clovelly.
Thank you for giving me a few minutes. I'll simply respond. Agent Krause did not make a report. She made no notes. She didn't read the agent's report who made it. I couldn't cross-examine her.
I'm sorry, so an agent did?
Agent Krause, the only one to testify who was there, relied strictly on her memory.
But somebody else did?
Somebody else made a report.
So there is a report of that meeting.
There is.
So there's some attendee whose name I don't remember, if I ever knew it.
Yes, there's a report.
And you had that report available to you to cross-examine if you
wanted. No, I couldn't because she didn't adopt it. She didn't read it.
You could use it to cross-examine, though, right?
No, I could not. She did not adopt the report. She did not read the report. Okay. She was relying
strictly on her memory. Could you have called the person who prepared the report?
Yes, I could have.
Okay, so what's the problem?
Well, I don't like saying that. My brief is misleading when it's accurate.
Well,
I'm sorry. I'm a little sensitive about that.
I appreciate that, and perhaps I read too much into your assertion that Agent Krause did not make a report, because I would have... I understood that to mean that there wasn't a report, but you've cleared that up. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. And the July 13 tape... He says, why do you insist on checks? And she says, well, not that I insist. You can give me all cash. She says, I'm going to report it anyway. But then on the 19th, there's no question. He says to her, did you consider what I told you last week? And she says, no, I did not. I do not want to change. I still want checks. It's clear as a bell. And as far as the unique guide, the only reason for that was to show that she was trying to follow the law. She goes online. She buys this book. The first chapter is all about the law. It's gobbledygook to her. The other 350 pages is all about how to run a marketing outfit. And she gets ideas from that. And she testified, I went through the index. I was a little concerned, but, you know.
Okay.
I don't really, and it was 5 years earlier. I mean,
all right.
It just goes to her good faith, Judge.
All right. So
Thank you very much, Mr. Clovelly. Thank you, Judge Rovner.
And you are appointed by this court, as I understand it. Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you very much.
Thanks as well to the government. We'll take the case under advisement.